So anyway, I'm David, and I am a cocaine addict. And Mark H., that's a tough act to follow. Jeez. That guy's got any music talent, he might be a rock star one day. You know? So, yeah. So anyway, well, thank you for so much for inviting me here to speak. It's a privilege and an honor to be here. My sobriety date is March 1st, 1990. My home group... That was not my idea, by the way, sobriety, you know, and certainly they have 18 years, you know. If all goes as well, I should be picking up an 18-year chip here in about 3 weeks, but, you know, we live in today, so we'll see how that goes. But my home group is actually the Razor's Edge, right? And I shared with, our brother-sister group here, Pete and I did the workshop this morning, so that's awesome. I'm glad you guys have a Razor's Edge. We have some funny names for groups, don't we? Like, I know in Phoenix we have Diet Coke, It Hurts When You Do It Dry, you know. I'm not a member of that group, by the way. Yeah, why not? Maybe you should join it. I don't know, but it sounds painful. But so anyway, I'll kind of keep it short tonight. We got a 13-step dance right after this, so we'll get on to that. I won't bore you with the details. So anyway, I was born and raised just right over here in Minnesota, right off I-90, a little town called Jackson, Minnesota. In fact, I wasn't even didn't grow up in the town. I grew up on a farm north of the town, and. Born and raised there, great life, was raised a Lutheran, went to church on Sunday, good parents. My parents were farmers, my brother now runs the farm, and for whatever reason, at age 15, my brother asked me to go out and do some drinking with him, and I tasted alcohol a little bit when I was a kid, you know, a little couple sips off my dad's malt liquor, and I hated it, absolutely hated it. And this one night, we went out, and I had no reason to drink, but we did, And I drank some Southern Comfort, some peppermint schnapps, and chased it with some little Miller beer, some little ponies, right? It's a good Midwest beer, you know? And then smoked some Marlboro Reds like men do. And I took a couple swigs of it, and it was horrible. And then I took a couple more swigs, and all of a sudden it was like, man, I started to glow. I just got that warm, you know, on a cold winter night, and all of a sudden, that warm, fuzzy thing comes over you. And I laughed, and they laughed, and we went to the bowling alley and played Asteroids or whatever we did. And Asteroids, I think, was the game. And, man, I just drank into oblivion, had an awesome time, and woke up the next morning, which I think was a Saturday, and I just went, when are we going to do that again? That was awesome. And I look back on it, and really that was the beginning of the next 10 years of my life. Shortly thereafter, I had a couple of Mennonite friends, who I learned how to smoke pot and drop acid and do all kinds of non-spiritual things with, you know. And, in fact, first time I smoked pot, I went on this Lutheran roller skating function. And smoking... Actually, it was the second night, because the first night I smoked it, I didn't get high. And I thought, see, there you go. It's not non-addictive marijuana, you know. Everybody's making a big deal about this. And so the second night, we went on this roller skating function. And, of course, right as I walk in the door with all the other Lutherans and pay my money to get the skates is when the buzz comes over. And I was laughing and had the munchies and just had an amazingly good time. But as it went for me, everything that I did, I drank, no one died, no one went to jail, all good, I'll be doing that again. Smoke pot, no one died, no one went to jail, all good, I'll be doing that again. I had 2 months of continuous sobriety, and about 2 months into my drinking, right before I turned 16, I got pulled over at a party, at a keg party, and actually I wasn't even driving, my friend was driving, he was 16, and we got pulled over, and I got just a little slap on the wrist of an open container ticket, and I had to go to court, so my parents grounded me, I got my license, and it was very uneventful because then I had to come home after school and I was grounded for 2 months. So I had 2 months of continuous sobriety I put together because I couldn't drink. Now the interesting thing is during those 2 months, all I could think about was, I can't wait till this is over so I can drink again, which I guess would be described as a mental obsession of sorts, right, as we talked about today in the first step. But so as soon as that's, the grounding was lifted, I was off and running and off I went, and I played in rock and roll bands back here when I was growing up. And so I hooked up with this one group out of Iowa, and the drummer, his dad, I think, was a doctor, and he had some money, and so this drummer guy had some cocaine from the Iowa cocaine cartel. And one night, he broke some of that out, and I couldn't wait. I was like, this is awesome. This is so rock and roll, you know? And so I did cocaine, and I don't remember getting high from it, quite honestly, from that Iowa cocaine. But we did some, and I just remember going, you know, no one died, no one got arrested, all is good, I'll be doing more of that. And on it went. So I graduated high school. I moved out to, I'm going to shut down a little. Oddly enough, you moved to Arizona, right? You used to move there to not have allergies. Now all there is allergies there. So anyway, I just got there. I was on a trip, and I traveled and came home and got some crud. So anyway, I'm not sick. I'm just working through it. So actually, Tim told me, he goes, don't worry, come back here. It's so cold. No allergy can possibly survive back here. So pardon me if I suck on a little lozenge here. But at 18, I graduated high school. About 5 days later, I moved out to California. And I pursued a music career, which went well for me. And it was great because when I got out there, I mean, one of the things my father said to me, who was quite conservative and was really a businessman who ran our family farm, he said, David, so whatever you do, do not do that cocaine. I said, Dad, I would never do that cocaine. Why would I do that? You know? And cocaine at this time was like on the cover of Time magazine, was starting to be kind of a popular drug out in Hollywood. Quite honestly, I couldn't wait to get out there to do some cocaine. I mean, it looked like the greatest thing ever. I mean, if you're on the cover of Time, you're pretty big, you know? So I got out there, and all of a sudden they had this exquisite menu of marijuana. You know, they had Maui Waui and, you know, Mexican this and, you know, Thai Bud and Northern California Sensimilia, and it all had different scents, and it smelled different, and it weighed different. Some was sticky, and some had nice white crystal THC on it. I mean, it was like a whole science in itself, you know. Yeah, right? And so all of a sudden, getting used to all of this, and a friend of mine then, you know, he had a triple beam scale, and he'd score pot. And it was like one of these secret missions. And I was the guy that had the car, of course, so I was the driver, you know. And one day, he goes and he scores some cocaine, and he brings it back. And we do some cocaine, and I was one of these cocaine users that when I would do it, I would do a lot of cocaine and sit around and have a million things to say, but too lockjawed to say any of it. You know? And I quickly realized, hanging out with this guy, that he who holds the cocaine is the master of ceremonies at any event, right? So he lays some cocaine out. I do some. I get really high and can't think of, you know, can't say anything. So the whole time I'm looking at the pile of coke, just going, God, I wish he'd give me some more cocaine. But not wanting to look bad, I didn't say anything. So then he says, hey, David, you want another wine? And I'd be like, well, all right, I'll take another one. You know? Trying to be modest. Be a modest cocaine. Because, you know, someone who really wanted to do another one might be a cocaine addict, for crying out loud. And I wouldn't want to be that, because then I'd have to stop doing cocaine, which would be horrible. So, right? So my management of my drug use started really from day one, quite honestly. And, you know, my thing was, as long as I just do your drugs, I couldn't quite possibly be an addict, you know? The day comes that I'm buying my own, and that's pathetic, right? Because that's what drug addicts do. So eventually, I start buying little $25 bundles of cocaine. And I was hanging out with some guys who were jazz musicians. And they were like, man, if you really want to be great, you got to do heroin. Now, heroin to me was stuff that, like, you know, dead people did. You know? Sid Vicious and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, and, like, really good but famous dead people, right? But so one night I'm really high in cocaine. We do some heroin. And I'm like, and they're like, don't worry about it, man. It'll feel like you're back in your mother's womb. Right? You're just floating in a bowl of liver. I'm like, well, I could use that. I'm pretty high in cocaine right now. That could be a good idea. So so I snort up some heroin. And And it didn't, I didn't really notice it, to be honest with you. I was like, wow. I was kind of like, again, smoking the marijuana. I was like, wow, nobody died, no one went to jail. This is completely overrated, this whole thing. So I'll certainly be doing more of that. And that's kind of how it went for me, is I realized that when I did cocaine, if I did some heroin, it brought me down, you know? And when I was trying to be on good behavior, I would just drink alcohol and maybe take some bong hits because, you know, alcohol and marijuana is non-addicting. And alcohol, I mean, I did that back in Minnesota. That's pretty harmless, right? So, you know, it's kind of, that was my sort of rationalization for this whole thing. Well, the day came, of course, when one morning I woke up and I was, you know, partying, because it was still a party at that point. And I felt, man, I felt, you know, crappy. And so I did up another, I snorted up another line of heroin, and all of a sudden I felt wonderful. And I went, uh-oh, this isn't good. And I'd watched my friends, you know, running out to El Monte, scoring bags of, you know, Mexican heroin in very bizarre, dangerous places, coming home and shooting it up. And I was afraid of needles, because again, that's what real junkies use, needles. I'm just snorting it, crying out loud, you know. And so all of a sudden I went, uh-oh, I got a monkey on my back. And I realized what that was. Now, it's interesting that only an addict, you know, the further down the scale I went, the cooler I thought I was. To the point that eventually I started driving downtown to these, you know, little streets of ill repute in Los Angeles with my long hair and my skinny little peg leg jeans and my white high tops, you know, looking a little out of place. And my red sports car. And I'm buying heroin at the window, you know, in these little hotels downtown. And finally, you know, I became the guy who was, you know, who was buying the stuff. And I remember one morning driving downtown after being up all night, watching people go up into, like, the Bank of America building, you know, people dressed nice in their suits and their briefcases, you know, going to work, looking at these people going, what a bunch of losers these people are. Having jobs, going to work, I mean, you know, just thinking like, man, if they only knew what I knew, if they'd only been down underneath, you know, the gutters where I am living, they would really know what life is about. And to me, that really, I find it interesting that the Big Book just never uses the word bottom, but it does use the words pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that's a point we can get to wherever we're at in our lives, right? That way I don't have to go, where's my bottom, where's my bottom? You know, because my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization may happen before you, it may happen after you, you know, but at some point, I know where that's at. And I started feeling that along the way. Now, I was traveling a lot. I was playing rock and roll bands, and, or a band, and traveling the world. And having a heroin addiction is kind of a problem when you got to travel a lot, right? I remember... So, at the time, though, there was some overnight freight companies, and they were wonderful, because the one had a slogan that when it positively, absolutely has to be there overnight, that was their slogan. And I remember seeing that going, this is brilliant, this is awesome. And, you know, unfortunately, some people got caught doing that and did some time in jail. Unfortunately, that wasn't me. And... because my addiction kind of ground my whole traveling to a halt much, you know, before that happened to me, quite honestly, for the grace of God. And the first, you know, what had happened, how I had come to find sobriety really was I used from 15 to 25 years of age. At 25, I got sober. And at about age 22, 23 maybe, I was living with a girl. And we drank a ton, and she did not want me to do cocaine or heroin because obviously that's what drug addicts do, right? So one morning she overheard a conversation that I had with a friend of mine about some heroin that I had, and she found it, and she freaked out and dumped my brown heroin all over the brown carpet, and I freaked out, you know, this atrocity of my dope being on the floor. And knowing I was going to be very dope sick, that was really the beginning of the end, and... I had some big concerts over in Europe that I was doing, and I did one of them, and I had to cancel a couple of the other ones, and it was really, you know, it was kind of a blow to, it certainly caused some stagnation of my business life on that level. And I came home, and I went into the Van Nuys hospital to a drug and alcohol treatment center that they had out there, and the agreement was I was going to go in for 10 days. Well, I got in there, and all of a sudden I realized that even though I went in there for, you know, my girlfriend, they were really mean to me in there, you know? They did things like put me in the middle of a circle and, you know, tell me to, like, sit up and unfold my arms, and, you know, they made me cry. It was just horrible, right? And wasn't at all like playing rock concerts for some reason. It was way different from that. And here I am, I'm sitting there in this thing, and all of a sudden the thought comes to me, goes, you know what? I don't think any girl is worth detoxing over. I don't like this. And I think I might leave this place, because why would I, you know? And I'm not like everybody else that's here. And this is right. This is like 1988. A lot of people in my industry were getting sober. It was really a big movement. You know, you read the thing about the anonymity deal. I mean, a lot of people were breaking anonymity on huge levels, on all the levels of press, radio, television. And but at one level, it was an attraction. Unfortunately, many of those people are now loaded, which is, I guess, maybe the lesson in that, is that, you know, when we, you know, put our sobriety out there, whether it's one-on-one, and I think that's why, you know, we have that tradition. Well, I know it's why we have it on the public level, is because if one of us falls, we tend to make the entire society look bad. And what has happened, you know, when we come out and we say that we are alcoholic, whether it's in a work setting or one-on-one or anything, there's a responsibility now that goes with that. You know, the responsibility being I better suit up and show up and do it when I'm saying I'm doing. So I really resented that a lot of people in the entertainment industry were getting sober, because quite honestly, I was kind of just getting my heroin addiction up and running. And I was kind of pissed off that it was going to be coming to an end. And my industry was not supporting financially, you know, funding rock bands, making records, and a lot of money was on the table and going out and doing tours when people were strung out on drugs, and management companies weren't supporting it. So basically, it was kind of like either you go to rehab or, you don't have a gig kind of mentality. So anyway, I lasted 3 days in this one treatment center, and I left. Went home, got high on the way home, of course. But anybody who's been to rehab knows that going to rehab will absolutely ruin your using from then on out. I don't recommend it. If you want to keep using, it's a bad thing to do, to go to rehab. Because it will be the beginning of the end, somehow. And I know some people who go to rehab, and of course that seed is planted, and so a lot of them don't make it back here, and they OD and they pass away and things like that. So those of us that actually get here are the lucky few, and most don't, as we know. But I heard things like, there's an AA meeting that came in, and just in 3 days I heard a lot. One was, you know, I may have an illness, and if I have it, it's progressive and it's fatal. And that I would not be able to go back to what it was like when I was 15, drinking the Southern Comfort in Minnesota, that I had progressed far beyond that. And even if I stopped using for any period of time, that to go back out, I was going to pick up right where I left off, or even worse. And I proved that to be true. And I was immediately strung out by the time I got home, after 3 days in the treatment center. And for about 2 months or so, I continued on the way I was, and boy, things got worse quick. And the fun was over. My group had just come to a halt. My career had just come to a halt. I was, you know, spending, I had this little trick where I would just kind of take my paycheck and just use it all to, you know, buy dope, and failed to pay the taxes on that, which does catch up to you eventually. And so finally I put myself into another treatment center at the Brotman Hospital in Culver City. I lasted there for about 2 weeks. And suddenly, I mean, out of nowhere, man, I was kind of digging it, actually. I was getting into it. I was liking it. And all of a sudden, you know, a friend of mine was in another treatment center. He left. So I figured I'd leave. I went out. And that day, I'm at the dope dealer's house begging him, please sell me some cocaine. And he's like, you crazy? You just got out of rehab. You know? But any good drug dealer who's a good businessman will eventually, you know, see a potential sale sitting in his living room. So enough begging and pleading and, you know, please sell me some cocaine. So he finally, you know, I get some coke, I get some heroin, and I'm strung out. And I mean, within hours, I'm worse than I was 2 weeks ago. So again, I proved what they told me to be true. Apparently, I have this illness, and it is progressive, and it's getting progressive really quick. So I went back into rehab. A friend of mine actually came over, a guy that had worked for me, and said, ma'am, you know, going into a treatment center is a sign of strength, not weakness. never forget that. It's a sign of strength, not weakness. Because I look at it like I'm weak. I can't handle it. I have to go to rehab. That's rehab's for losers. You know, what's that T-shirt? Rehab's for quitters, right? Right? Which we all laugh at now. So I went back in. And I stayed in there for the month, and I didn't stay sober. In fact, I've learned how to chase the dragon off some Winston cigarette pack with this one Iranian guy that was in there that had smuggling heroin into the rehab, you know. So, arts and crafts, I learned, you know. But honestly, I just wasn't there. I went back in. I was trying to get it, but it didn't come around, you know. Which a few of us talked about that earlier at lunch day or something too, or dinner tonight. That you know, a lot of times, man, you know, we're in here right now. This body of people right here. And unfortunately, some of these seats are going to rotate a little bit. And some people won't be here at this time next year for whatever reason. So, man, the fact that we're here now, you know, that great delusion of all addicts is that I think that, you know, this will always be here for me. And it is always here for us. But the truth of the matter is, you know, we tweak a few things in our lives. And next thing you know, we're out there going, shit, how did I get out there? Now I wish I was in here. Because that was the story of my life. I always wanted to be somewhere else with someone else doing something else. You know, I was never happy just being right here, right now. And so I went through several methadone treatments and whatnot. And that just, you know, quite honestly, instead of getting up heroin, all that did is it just added another one. I'd get up, I'd go to the methadone clinic in the morning. Then I'd go get some cocaine because I'm a little knotted out from the heroin. And then by, you know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, I got to get some heroin to come down from the cocaine. So now I've just added another thing on the menu, you know. And that didn't work out well, you know, the methadone plan. But, in fact, that was a nasty detox, man. That was painful. My bottom of my feet would hurt when I'd get out of bed to go to the clinic and get my dose in the morning. It was like, oh, my feet hurt. It's horrible. excuse me. So, you know, eventually, the guys I was working with, we really pretty much came to a pact. It's like, look, you know, you use, you lose. Everyone in this organization's got to get sobered up and get on the page. And I really resented that, quite honestly, because how dare anybody tell me to get sober? Even though I knew darn good and well I needed to get sober. You know, I knew I needed it, I just didn't want you to tell me that. Really, you know. It's a little defect of character called pride. And I don't know any other alcoholics that have that, but right. So eventually I was introduced to this little Mexican bank robber guy who was about 5 years sober in NA, a guy who I seemingly had nothing in common with. And he was wonderful because he would sit there and he'd laugh and I'd tell him a couple and he'd tell me a couple. And I realized this guy gets it, man. This guy knows what's going on. And I'd tell him things like, you know, I'm just going to do heroin, but I'm not going to smoke pot. And he'd do the ha, ha, ha. You know, the sponsor laugh. Ha, 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 ha. You go ahead and try that. Or I'd say, well, I'm just not going to do any heroin. I'm just going to drink now, and I'm just going to smoke some pot. And then he led me to the conclusion that I really didn't even like drinking and smoking pot anymore because I was really in love with heroin. He goes, why don't you just go do heroin? I mean, that's really what you want to do. Why even mess around with the other stuff, right? So I proved him right as well. I tried all these different methods. And you know, more about alcoholism, it talks about all these different methods that the alcoholic tries. I tried every one of those. And I had to, because eventually I conceded to my innermost self, not you conceding to my innermost self, but me conceding to my innermost self that I really was an addict. And what I realized is that, you know, when it comes to cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and alcohol, man, I can't control it, and I can't stop once I start. And it's probably a good idea if I don't take anything else, because it seems like when I take something else, it sort of cuts me off from this contact and this clarity that I have, this clarity seeming to be a conscious connection with God. And the way I came to that is one night I came home from a party, and one of those horrible things happened. They ran out of Jack Daniels, and they started serving Seagram 7, which is a way step down for me, right? And I was like, oh. And the cocaine was bad. It was just a bad party, period, you know? And then to make things worse, I come down the steps and I run right into a whole bunch of AA people. Right? And one of those, like, you know, you're like, oh my God. Hey man, how's it going? Yeah, yeah, no, things are great, man. Oh, well, life's great. You know, you're trying to convince the AA people that everything's really going good, even though they haven't seen you at any meetings and they know otherwise, and they kind of give you that, you know, amused skepticism look, you know. I love Bill's words in the book, amused skepticism, you know. Yeah, kind of the ha, 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 laugh. So I went home that night, room was spinning, and I'd been to enough AA, I knew we prayed around these rooms. Been to CA too. CA was actually brand, you know, fairly new at that time in the late 80s. This was 89. And I just laid in my bed, and I prayed, and I essentially did steps 1, 2, and 3. I admitted powerlessness. I decided, you know, I know there's a God. I'd been to church. Even before I started using, I'd had an awesome spiritual experience. I remember even talking to my mother about it one time when I was a kid. She was bringing me home from school, and I said, man, I feel good, Mom. I'm praying. I'm going to Bible school. I'm happy. My friends and I get along well. And it was, I look back, that was a spiritual experience. Now, for whatever reason, I started drinking right around that time. But, and I know now what that is. That's what we talked about today in the workshop, the lie. And the lie is that thing that we hear every single alcoholic and addict who speaks at these podiums share, which goes something like, I didn't feel like I was good enough. I didn't think I fit in. I wasn't a part of. I wasn't like them. Ad infinitum, right? It's the same lie. And that lie generally, at some point, because I know other people who didn't go out and drink with their brother, because quite honestly, they were like, you know, why would I do that? I would mess my life up. Common sense, right? But for whatever reason, when I look back on my life, and I only discovered this through doing inventory, is that at some point, going out and doing that to fit in, because I didn't feel like I fit in. And as I look back over my life, there were a lot of times that I did not feel a part of. I just felt like an alien on the planet, you know? And I used to lie when I was a kid. One time I just flat out shot my brother with a BB gun. He freaked crying. You know, dead, you know, parents, and, and I go, what? No, I shot it off that thing, and it ricocheted, and it hit him. And, I mean, first thing is not to tell the truth and come clean. The first thing is to do wrong things and then lie about it, right? You know, this, and look, again, I was a good little kid. I went to Sunday school. I learned about Noah's Ark. I did all the stuff, right? I did the footwork. But really, when it came right down to it, you know, I, for whatever reason, and you know, my sponsor led me through this little process in the fourth step about getting down to causes and conditions, which is that, you know, when the good Lord put each of us here, you know, he set us here because he meant for us to be here. And somewhere along the line, I bought into the lie. And the lie was either I heard, you know, someone say it, or I was around kids and I didn't feel enough, I didn't feel a part of, whatever, that essentially the lie was, I'm not good enough. And I've heard every alcoholic and every addict say it. Once I discovered it, I'm like, holy cow. Every I don't know one addict who said, you know, I really felt good about life, so I went out and I smoked some crack. Never heard it, right? Things were grooving, man. I'm making money. My marriage is great, so I shot up some heroin. It was just killer. You wouldn't, you know. People don't go that way, you know. Us ending up on that part where we pick up the very poison that we know is bad for us, you know. You know, that's the result of believing the lie. And I encourage everybody to get to know what the lie is, because it's awesome. It's great. It now, going through inventory, every time any fear creeps up, why? Because of the lie. You know? And obviously the opposite of the lie is, I am good enough. I do belong here. I'm put here for a reason. We find that when we get to the third step, because that's what I came to, which is, you know what? I'm not under the brutality and beatings of a higher power. I turn my will and my life over to the care of a power greater than myself. Care, that little word. It's a wonderful word. Over to the care of a power as I understand it. Now, it's funny because a short while later, and that was really the beginning of my sobriety, and that was toward the end of 1989, and I had a couple little, you know, little slippy-do things, and they weren't even slips because it was all part of, I'm like the guy in the back of the book of the spiritual experience appendix. I did not have a white light experience. I am of the educational variety. And one of the things that really cemented that is I went back home to Minnesota around Christmas of 89, and my dad wanted to go to church, so I went to church with him. And I sat in the Lutheran church I grew up in, and I heard the pastor talk. And all of a sudden, I'd been going to some AA meetings, and I had a sponsor. I was reading the big book. My sponsor was starting to take me through some steps, and the lights were coming on. And what I heard was, in the Lutheran church, even though their vernacular was different than what we say here, all of a sudden, that God was the same God we talk about here. And what was awesome about that is all that prejudice I had about organized religion and all these different things, it all, all of a sudden I realized, you know what? There's one God, and I'm cool with that. G-O-D, good orderly direction. That's what they told me early in sobriety. You know, well, another thing they told me early in sobriety is, you know, David, there's only one thing you got to change, and that's everything. That sounds like a tall order, doesn't it? And I freaked. And he said, don't worry about it. He won't change it all at once. But it is all going to change. And I got to tell you, everything in my life has changed. Everything. You know, up until a few years ago, you know, I played in a pretty big rock group, a former bass player of a big group called Megadeth. And, yeah, and I don't say that to, for any other reason than, you know, I through that process, I kept kind of riding the last few years of that going, uh-oh, they said everything's got to change. This is one thing that hasn't changed. And one day, the day came. And what changed it was my recovery. My recovery essentially pulled me out of it, you know. And I looked back on that, and even as it was happening, it was a lot of fear around it, you know, when a relationship changes, a job changes, a career change, whatever it is. But, you know, God motored me through it and got me onto other stuff right now. In fact, the reason I have to leave to go home early tomorrow, this is funny to me, I got to go home because I'm a music worship leader at the Lutheran Church. That's right? So, so tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor, right? Amen. Good Lord. So anyway, it's and I mean that kind of sums it all up, quite honestly, you know, from death to life, you know. You know, when I got sober, I did an inventory, and I didn't really know what I was doing other than I had an NA book, actually, that had a fourth-step booklet. And so I started writing it out. I shared it with my sponsor and went through the sixth step, and that was all I did. I went on tour. I didn't really do any more. Some other defects of character came up, in my case, sex, you know. Go figure. Some people have gambling, you know. We talked today about seven deadly sins. You know, oftentimes if you're not working if you're not working a program of recovery, alcoholism and drug addiction will show up in your life in other ways other than a crack pipe. That's what I've discovered, right? And I know now for a fact that if I, for some reason, would depart out of this program, it wouldn't show up because it was a needle full of heroin. Because if somebody walked up to me with a crack pipe right now, I'd recoil as if from a hot flame, like it says in the 10th step. You know, it's always some other thing. Hey, want to make a little money on the side? You know, whatever it may be. You know, some cute girl, whatever. That is what I've seen takes addicts out of here. You know, it's those kind of things. It never shows up in the form of a crack pipe, at least initially. It's always some other thing that can be so deceptive, and that's when they talk about, you know, cocaine, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. So those are the things that I've learned in my journey that, you know, the church calls it Satan. Around here we call it self-centeredness. Seems to be the same thing. Appropriate tongue. Yeah, right. That's good. Yeah, that's God, man. I mean, he's like, let me set a little tune down there for these guys. You know? But the importance of that being is that at about 4 years sober, 3.5 years sober, I moved from Los Angeles out to Phoenix, and I moved out there. And I didn't know anybody. And I should go back and say that the first sponsor that I had, the little Mexican bank robber guy, was wonderful for me. At a year sober, he shot dope and died. And he was running a pretty prominent treatment center. So to me, it's kind of not really it's kind of a no-brainer. I can look back on it now and see why that happened. I got hooked up with a new sponsor out in Phoenix in 1993. He took me through the steps. And that was really when I joined Cocaine Anonymous. Was at almost 4 years sober. And that was the first time I went through all 12 steps. I made all my amends. I went around the world and I saw a lot of people that weren't even on my inventory. I went, oh my God. So if in doubt, I made amends to you. I drove some people crazy, but I wanted this deal, you know. I wanted to make direct amends. I wanted my side of the street clean because I saw what defects of character were doing to my life and the pain and suffering they caused a lot of other people. And shortly thereafter, I got married. And then my sponsor that I had in in Phoenix just a couple years ago had gotten loaded, and he passed away. And he also was running a treatment center. I don't know. I'm kind of getting the connection there. And the connection I get on that isn't so much that running a treatment center is bad, but that, you know, this deal really around here, this is, we do this for free and for fun. You know, no one's getting paid the big bucks being here. You know, we're all just another member amongst members. We're all just another little person here. We all have various jobs. Tonight my job is, you know, come up and tell your story. You know, Mark is run around like a crazy man and get the crowd pumped. You know, someone's going to be here putting chairs away. That person's just as important as anybody on any other job. Someone else has, you know, been working for probably months putting together some travel arrangements or arranging liaison with the hotel, and someone's going to be here sweeping the floors and cleaning the cake and doing those jobs. But all these jobs are just as important as the next one. And that's the cool thing here. And most, what I've seen, a lot of people that kind of rise up the ranks and become important in an anonymous program does not fare so well, you know. And again, it's the propensity of the ego to come out with us addicts. And again, the crack pipe doesn't show, it doesn't just walk right up to you, does it? It comes usually in another way. So just my, you know, I don't know. I've just seen it happen twice with me in my life. With, I mean, maybe it's me. Maybe I don't. It could be, but I don't think it's me killing those monsters. I don't know. Something's happening. Wouldn't be so arrogant to think it's me. But so anyway, I got a, you know, had to get a new sponsor, which is fine. I, you know, fortunately, I'm, you know, pretty hooked into a tribe of people, and my sponsor is, you know, the one who really got the back to basics thing going, which has kind of been a discussion. And I'm, man, I'm so fortunate he took me through that, because boy, he, you know, he got me off the nipple, because to be a large degree, you know, I was kind of brought up like, you know, call your sponsor, talk to your sponsor. And for a few years, I was just like, you know, I'm kind of attached to my sponsor. I'm just like, this can't be what this is about, because I'm not that happy either. And boy, I tell you what, you know, I called my sponsor when I first got into my sponsor. He said, man, I got an issue and I need to talk to you. And he goes, well, did you take it into 11 step? And I'm like, of course not. I'm calling you. I want you to tell me what to do. And boy, and he goes, dude, look, let me tell you something. That is not what this deal's about. And he took me through the steps, and similar to what we did this morning in the workshop, and we went through the thing, and, you know, I started to notice, you know what I really noticed? We've been talking about the 2000 convention in Phoenix, the world. You know, guys like Mark H. and Chris R., they were getting up, and these guys, people with long-term sobriety, I think Mark had like 16 years or something at the time, or 18 years, and everybody that had long-term sobriety was always talking about how deep they were into meditation, and I wasn't doing any meditating. And so one of the really the biggest gifts that I found in this deal is getting into the 11th step, which in the morning, get on my knees, get with God, have him direct my thinking, and spending some time there, you know, spending some time listening to God. And if page 86, if you haven't gotten there or you're in the steps and you're going to get there, man, I just can't even encourage you enough. Having spent years not doing it and now some years doing it, wonderful. Talk about going right to the source. And you know what I've come to realize is, again, back to the thing about the lie, you know, God put us here for a reason. I look back over my life, the only time I ever had any problems is when I wasn't checking in with the big guy. When I, you know, it's like Star Trek. When you're not channeling back to the home office, problems happen. Right? I mean, we send a man to the moon, they check in with Houston. Houston, we got a problem. All right, we'll help you solve it, right? I mean, that's the whole point of it. So we've kind of been sent down here. At least this is my interpretation of the deal, you know, and you know, it seems like scripture in that other big book kind of validates this theory, you know, is that, you know, we're really meant to be reporting back up to the master. And whoever you believe that to be. And then we are not alone, we're not here by ourselves, and we're all connected. And that's the other thing. And sometimes you don't notice that until you come to a meeting, you go, oh, that's right, we are connected. Or you come to a big convention like this, and you're even bigger conventions, of course, and you look around, and, you know, these big rooms of people, you go, holy smoke, we are connected. And that's awesome, isn't it? Isn't that a cool thing? We feel a part of here, but it's like we're not just here. It's not just our tribe, man. Our tribe's hooked into everything else out there. So I sat in the one meeting today, the marathon meeting, about, you know, living the program, you know, and I realized that, you know, we spend an hour in a meeting or whatever we do, and, you know, this is just kind of the, you know, the rejuicing, the recharge, and the plugging back in. You know, really our better example of Cocaine Anonymous is what we're doing outside the rooms, you know, and that I'm glad, you know, actually be honest with you, being on tour all these years, being sober, people go, oh man, how can you be on tour and stay sober? To be honest with you, I kind of found it easy. Because it was like, man, I was, you know, the mini bars in the room, And if the minibar's talking to me, then I'm not in fit spiritual condition. And the minibar ain't talking to me, I seem to be safe and protected wherever I go. And I'm lucky that, you know, once I got this deal, you know, in March of 1990, man, I have not had to, you know, go back out. That has been, but again, it took me a year and a half, and that was just part of my deal. So anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. And thank you so much for having me here, and enjoy the rest of the convention. Thank you much. Bye-bye.